All right, thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here this afternoon and to be part of this very interesting meeting and to be part of this Leopoldina session this afternoon. Thank you for the invitation, and it's a very impressive place here, especially this Hungarian Academy of Sciences building is a most impressive place. Similar to the previous speakers, what I'll try to do is give some overview of the past, present, and future, in this case of HIV-AIDS research. Where do we come from, where do we stand right now, and what is to be expected in the near future? And to start out with this slide, it's of course a much closer time period that we're looking at. It's really 30 years this year, and this is the first report here that was published in 1981 in the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly report of the first cases of HIV-AIDS, a clear case of very observant physicians finding out something which was different from what they knew and reporting of it. Five young homosexual men in the Los Angeles area who died from opportunistic infections in an unusual way. And it took only a short period of time, only 2 years, until the French group of Françoise Barré-Sinoussi and Luc Montagnier reported on a virus which was later known as HIV as the causative agent of the disease that these young men suffered from. They were awarded the Nobel Prize 25 years later for this discovery. So if I put this on a timeline, and I'll just give you a rather personal view of the developments that happened since, if I put this on a timeline of 30 years of HIV-AIDS research, then we have 81, the first cases reported. Very shortly thereafter, the virus was first discovered. Antibody tests and blood screening was implemented in the mid-1980s, and then other diagnostic tests came until viral load was introduced as the gold standard in the 1990s. If you put on this same timeline sort of the virology discoveries, and this is, of course, a personal account, you could select different ones on this, that happened in this time, as I said, 83, the discovery of the virus as a causative agent. Shortly thereafter, tools became available to work with this virus. The receptor that was needed, CD4, for entry into cells was discovered very shortly thereafter in 86, the second retrovirus, the second HIV causing AIDS at a much less frequent, lower frequency was discovered, and then additional molecules needed to enter the cells were found. SIV, a chimpanzee relative of HIV, was discovered in the 1990s and was then the sort of tool to find out where the virus comes from, as was said in the previous discussion, a monkey to human transmission from chimpanzee to man, probably in the early part of the 20th century as the first transmission that led to the pandemic. And in the 2000s, cellular factors, so-called restriction factors, were found to be increasingly important in the containment of HIV in certain people that were able to control the virus for a prolonged period of time. And this now sometimes called intrinsic immunity of persons that have a lower susceptibility to the disease-causing properties of the virus now is a major factor in research. If you again, on the same scale, put sort of how therapy developed, then it was in the late 1980s when azithromycin, a drug that had been previously shown to be effective against retrovirus, was first tried. It was actually highly unsuccessful at that time for reasons that were only understood later. In the 90s, other inhibitors like azithromycin against reverse transcriptase were discovered, but it was only in 1995-96 when protease inhibitors targeting a different stage in the viral life cycle were added to the therapeutic arsenal, and it became clear that what was known for years, for decades, from tuberculosis research, that it is combination therapy that will be successful and a single therapeutic agent will not work successfully, was also introduced here and led to a major success of the highly active antiretroviral therapy ever since. Other inhibitors were added in the late 1990s. Prevention of mother-to-child transmission, that's what PMTCT stands for, was introduced, and I'll come back to this later. Post-exposure prophylaxis, this is the typical case of the needle stick injury where you give drugs right after the injury and thereby prevent the early infection, was introduced and further drug classes came in the 2000s up to now. And the last step is pre-exposure prophylaxis, a new concept which I'll also come back to. And lastly on this slide, how about the vaccine situation? That's looking at the accomplishment and achievements of all the other parts. The sad story in this way, in the 1980s already the first phase one trials on split vaccines on antigens from the virus were tried. Around early 1990s, attenuated viruses were tried in monkeys but were found not to be safe. And then all vaccine trials basically failed. Those that were on the conventional basis, as well as in 2006 or so, the very much expected step trial, a prime boost vaccine, similar to what Stefan Kaufmann talked about prime boost regimens before, where different antigens was used for priming and boosting, completely failed. And it was in 2008 the first positive report on a possibly marginally successful vaccine approach. And again, I'll come back to this. So where do we stand today? We still have about 30 to 35 million people infected. I could use the same slides from the world mapper that Stefan Kaufmann showed on tuberculosis, and you would see the same thing. The very large majority of cases in sub-Saharan Africa, it is still very much a poverty-associated disease. You can also see this in countries like the United States, where there are studies in Philadelphia, and you can basically look at the net income per district, per zip code, and correlate that to the percentage of infected people, and it correlates very nicely. It correlates directly. You have in certain areas, especially of poor black American districts, you have similar infection rates as in large parts of Africa. So depending on where you look, these numbers can be very different. We still have 2.5 or so million new infections each year. The number of deaths has declined significantly due to therapy. I'll again come back to this briefly later, but the number of new infections has not. So where are we? The causative agent is known for almost 30 years now. We have very good diagnostic tests. There's no problem in diagnosis. When we have a wealth of knowledge about HIV origin, about its molecular biology, its cell biology, and its pathogenesis. Just very briefly, two slides from our own work. From these early electron micrographs that show you the typical shape of the HIV mature infectious particle, you can now go to very much detail and find in almost atomic detail the structure of the proteins inside the immature particle, the mature particle. We can reconstruct viral budding sites. We know the anatomy of the virus far better than most other non-symmetric viruses that we have in research. And we know something about the dynamics. These are movies now that I will show that show you fluorescent viruses coming from virus-producing cells. So you will see the appearance of little dots, little bright spots. Each one of them is a single human immunodeficiency virus that's produced from this cell. And over the time of 2 hours, which would be this movie, it's sped up, of course, over the time of 2 hours, you see hundreds of particles coming from this cell. And you can also do this on individual virions. You see the assembly, the brightness enlarges, then the completion. The virus recruits host factors and eventually at this moment is released from the surface of the cell into the media. We can say something about the kinetics of these processes. We can say something about the kinetics of these processes and know that it takes about 10 to 15 minutes to make an individual virus. And we know something about host factors, the structure, and all of these details. So we know a lot about this virus, and we have effective therapy that has turned HIV infection into some sort of a manageable chronic disease wherever it's affordable and wherever it can be used. We have a number of different classes of drugs. I don't want to go into the details of this replication cycle from virus entry up here through replication and the very important step of integration of the viral genome into the host cell genome, which is the major problem. Because once the genome is in the host cell genome, it will never be lost again. And as long as this cell or any cell coming from it lives, the viral genome will stay in it, and then new virions are produced. We have drugs, multiple effective drugs targeting 5 independent stages of HIV replication. It was also on the slide before with the 3 drugs against tuberculosis and 4 against malaria. So it's the most successful antiviral development we have ever seen, about 25 drugs from different classes. And the state-of-the-art combination therapy that I mentioned before, K can in fact achieve a sustained reduction of viral loads in almost all patients under treatment. How did that translate in the number of deaths? If we look in North America or Western Europe, this is a time scale from 90 to 2010. This is when the highly active antiretroviral therapy was introduced, and it dropped precipitously down. Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, in the mid-2005-2006 period of time, you see a turning point, and it will go down depending on availability of drugs and sustained drug treatment. Eastern Europe and Asia has not yet reached the treatment levels. So the implementation of treatment clearly reduces the number of AIDS-related deaths dramatically, but we need a sustained access to treatment. None of these is cure. All of these patients are still infected, and whenever people tried to take them off drugs, the virus came back and pathogenesis turned back as it had been before. We don't have cure. We need sustained access to treatment, and the problem of prevention to new infection is not overcome. Rate of new infection is still high. Antiretroviral resistance spreads. We cannot cure it, and no protective vaccine is in sight. And this brings me to the four points I want to briefly discuss in the remaining period here. The next aims: access to testing and treatment, AIDS as a poverty-related disease, antiretroviral resistance as a major emerging problem, prevent new infections. As said, they are still not going down dramatically. In Germany, the numbers are high, equally high each year, and is not going down, for example. And finally, the attempt to cure. Access to treatment, these are the numbers, and you see the red is sub-Saharan Africa. We now have about 6 million people on treatment, so the numbers have gone dramatically with increased availability of funds, but there are still 9 million people awaiting therapy. I will give you the example of prevention of mother-to-child transmission to mention what could be achieved. This is coverage, prevention of mother-to-child transmission on a global scale. What does that mean? The current guidelines suggest a short-term treatment, a short-term therapy to the mother in the late phase of pregnancy, during labor, and for the baby immediately after delivery. That is in cases where you do not have therapy of the mother in any case for other reasons, then you suggest this type of treatment. And the darkness here represents the relative coverage with the darkest color being 80% or more of all pregnant women receiving this prevention mother-to-child treatment intervention, and the light color being below 10 or 20% in this case. And what you see is that large parts of Africa are still well below 50% of coverage in this situation. This has been modeled, put into a mathematical model, what would happen if we change. We currently have about 350,000 transmissions from mother to child. Without any intervention, about every third child of an HIV-infected mother will be infected. With intervention, with full intervention, this number goes down to well below 1%. At the current time, with the current prevention programs, we have about 350,000 transmissions. If we would stop these prevention programs, we would be about 100,000 higher. If, however, this coverage of prevention of mother-to-child transmission would go to 90% coverage over here, 90%, that's the black open here, this is how the rate of transmissions from mother to child would drop until the year 2015. There is a clear possibility to eliminate mother-to-child transmission infection of newborns by HIV by the existing current measures, and it does not require any of the high-cost interventions that we have in the developed world. You don't need cesarean section as we do in the Western world in this case. This is without any further intervention. This would be the same if appropriate treatment care would be available in the region, and the last of these lines would be in addition that breastfeeding is stopped early on after the first year of life of the newborn. You could drop the number of new infections with HIV from mother to child to almost zero by these measures within the next decade. The measures are available, and the only point is they need to reach the people in need. Antiretroviral resistance is an emerging problem that happens in any infectious disease. We know it from antibiotic resistance, we know it from tuberculosis, we know it from malaria, chloroquine resistant as a major problem on a global scale. This is the situation in HIV as we currently have it. About one-third of patients needs to change therapy in the first year. About half of patients need to change therapeutic regimens in the first 2 years after being put on therapy. The main reasons are either side effects or drug resistance. We have resistance against any of the known drugs. We have cross-resistance and multi-drug resistance, resistance to classes, and we have transmission of resistant virus. We estimate about 10% of virus infection in Europe currently to be by at least partially resistant HIV viruses. This is not a major problem in this part of the globe because we have 25 drugs and 5 different classes, and the current combinations usually allow to sustain a good response in these people. But think of a situation 20, 30 years from now. If we still are in the situation that we need lifelong treatment, it's simply not predictable what will happen in the next decades. How will the tolerance be? How will the resistance develop? How will all of this go? But even more importantly, in most of the poorer countries, the second line treatment simply is not available in appropriate numbers. So when we come to the same point of having a large number of people needing to be put on a different regimen, we will have a problem. First line treatment is about $100 per year per patient. Second line treatment is about 1,000 euros per year per patient. And there you see the problem. Prevention of new infection, of course, would be the goal to really decrease the number. And this is a meta-analysis of several studies looking at different measures. And what is shown here is the number of studies on the y-axis. And the color coding is gray, means no positive or negative effect was reported. Green is a positive effect was reported. Red is a negative effect was reported. All the behavioral studies did not really help much. What was clear positive effect is male circumcision, which reduces HIV transmission by about half, but only in male. There's no direct benefit for women, except that they're less male infected if they are circumcised. Clearly also, early treatment reduces risk of transmission. This was always expected, but now directly proven. But importantly, all of the unspecific microbicide studies actually showed a negative outcome, an increased risk of transmission. The initial studies were done using vaginal gels with unspecific microbicidal principles, for example, some mild detergents, etc., and there was a clear increase in number of transmission, and the most likely reason is that the mucosal barrier was actually damaged by the vaginal gel, and thereby the transmission was enhanced through damage of the mucosal barrier in this case. So clear indication that this would do harm rather than do good. This does not say that microbicidal agents would not work, but clearly those that had been tried were actually harmful. What did work, however, is topical microbicides containing anti-HIV drugs. So if you use a topical microbicide, this is a fairly recent study from 2010 from South Africa, if you use a topical microbicide, that is a vaginal gel, without any of these unspecific compounds, but with a anti-HIV drug, which is also used in current regimens, there was a clear reduction of about half of the risk of infection in these patients. And this and the extremely good tolerance of some of these drugs has led to the proposal to use pre-exposure prophylaxis. The idea of pre-exposure prophylaxis is you take drugs before you are infected to prevent yourself from being infected. And there is this, of course, in a high-risk community, and there's this trial of 2,500 homosexual men, men having sex with men, from 6 countries, which took a daily oral prophylaxis for 1 year, 1 pill a day, and then they behaved as they would have without. And there was a clear difference in the number of new infections, and there was also drug measurement in this study. And the majority of people who were on drugs actually didn't take their drug properly. So if this was clear, this was taken out, then there was only 3 people that got infected in the tenofovir arm of the study that had a measurable drug level throughout the period. So there's a clear indication that this way of treating people or not treating, using a prophylaxis, using a drug, can work. But of course, there are problems. how long can you do that? Will people adhere? They didn't even adhere in this rather short study appropriately, access cost logistics. I don't think that will be a solution to the problem, but it's a very interesting development we had recently. Briefly to the vaccine, we have a very, very high variability of the virus. Superinfection with different isolates has been reported. There's no good animal models, different to influenza, different to tuberculosis. It's difficult to do challenge models. And all of the single recombinant viruses and prime boost vaccines did not work. So the situation with HIV vaccines is like written by Samuel Beckett, ever tried, ever failed, no matter, try again, fail better. And this is what the last 20 years really were. Until this study came about, and I don't want to put too much emphasis on it because it's not clear whether it was a real vaccine success. It was a prime boost regimen where they used a recombinant virus to deliver HIV antigens followed by proteins. A large study with 16,000 participants in Thailand with 30% reduction of infection in this group. However, this was marginally significant and it seemed to dilute out when the same people were followed up another 1 or 2 years. This difference seemed to disappear. So if anything, it's a suggestion that you can develop an HIV vaccine, but it's clearly not something that can be developed further. So many people have asked, can a preventive vaccine against HIV be developed at all? And my answer would be, why not? We have no real clear indication that it's impossible. From the monkeys, one would say you need a strong and sustained and a broad T-cell response, but you also need sustained titers of broadly cross-neutralizing antibodies. And all of the vaccines we had did not induce antibody responses, and clearly no cross-neutralizing broad antibody responses. Can it be achieved? Will it be effective against many, most, or all HIV variants? Research has changed in recent years and now goes in this direction that people look at antibodies from patients that control the virus for a good time, looking for broadly neutralizing human antibodies that may have a protective potential, identify these antibodies, and there were about 10 to 12 of those that were recently identified in the last couple of years. And then comes the difficult part. Make an antigen that induces this immunological response. Can this be achieved? I don't know. It's clearly tried, and if it would be successful, I think an addition of some of these antigens with a T-cell vaccine would be the way to go. Since we are here at this stage, anybody can guess that in the next 5 to 10 years there will be no vaccine that can be used in humans. Last point. Now that we have a good therapy and a sustained response, the question of can we cure HIV infection came back. I told you the virus remains latent, the genome stays in infected cells and is not taken out, and thereby when you stop therapy, the disease comes back, the virus comes back. There's this one patient who has been cured, the famous Berlin patient. He's actually not from Berlin, he was just treated there. A patient who had the very difficult situation, he had a well-controlled, therapy-controlled HIV infection, but he also got leukemia and required a stem cell transplant. And his physicians gave him a transplant from a donor who had a deletion in one of the important genes for HIV entry. And it's known that people who have these deletions are largely resistant to HIV infection. So they were hoping to treat his leukemia and the HIV infection at the same time. And it worked. No detectable virus load without therapy now 6 years after the engraftment. So this patient, I think, on a global scale, is probably the only person ever cured of HIV. But, of course, it's a major medical intervention. You would not do a transplantation to a person to cure him from HIV, severe side effects. It's not clear, really, why it was successful, because there were pre-existing variants that would not use this receptor, but it clearly worked. But that really put forward other approaches to this same direction. And what people are now thinking, and not only thinking, but actually approaching, is nucleases, tools in gene therapy approaches that would knock out the gene for this receptor. This is the gene that is needed for HIV entry into cells, CCR5. This is the gene where this donor had a deletion that helped this patient to be cured of his HIV infection. So people use nucleases to eliminate this gene from T cells, possibly later from stem cells of HIV-infected patients. So what you do is you take T cells from the patient, you treat these cells with a nuclease, and hope that you have a lot of cells that don't have this receptor anymore, and put these cells back into the patient and see what happens. And the first trial, the first phase one trial, was autologous T cells, 6 patients was reported in September this year. And the engraftment expanded, so these cells had a selective advantage to the other T cells. 1 year, a reduction for up to 2 logs of viral load. So it clearly did work. Will this cure? No, you only have a few T cells that may be resistant, but that may help your immunodeficiency, may reduce your therapy needs over time, and may help you to run for a longer time. You would really still have to replace everything to be successful. Other approaches are activating the virus in these latent cells and trying to kill these activated cells. And lastly, a future approach that may or may not work, trying to excise the HIV genome from the infected cells. If we can excise CCR5 from these cells, why not try to excise the HIV genome? There are trials in animals. This approach is being followed, but it's clearly not ready for clinical intervention yet. 10 years ago, I would have said HIV cure will not work. Now I think there's really a way that it could possibly work, but it's still early on to say whether it goes. This is the last slide. Where are we currently? The regimens are much easier, 1 or 2 pills a day. We have options for patients with resistant virus, less side effects, and increased global access to first-line therapy. In the near future, I think we can say there is long-term suppression and sustainable therapy in highly drug-experienced patients is possible, with acceptable long-term toxicity and preventive strategies in high-risk groups. So we go to a chronic manageable disease if affordable, and I said this before. For the future, access needs to meet the need. Can we cure? Can we do more effective prevention strategies? Otherwise, the problem will persist, and the vaccine I mentioned. And lastly, there's still this community of AIDS denialists. So please remember, tell everybody, talk to everybody. If you go to the internet, you still find this huge community of people. HIV has nothing to do with AIDS, and this is a horrible situation that should not be available on this science-educated world anymore. Thank you very much for your attention.